Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
Now, Monte, I always got to do a beverage check. What are you drinking?
I'm currently drinking a flavored sparkling water.
Very nice. What flavor?
It's a cherry flavored. It's called Boobly, which is a Canadian brand. I'm kind of doxing myself a little bit there, but that's fine.
Not that they couldn't tell.
I'm sure people will. Yeah, you could figure it out. A boot. Anyway, so.
Is that like a LaCroix type of thing?
Yeah, LaCroix. Yeah, it's like a more commonly, like LaCroix, we have it here. Or as I called it at first, LaCroix, because I'm like, you know, I'm Canadian. So, oh, LaCroix.
You know how to say French words.
Sort of.
Baseline.
Yeah. Like, yeah, some of the Templar and like Hugh de Palme.
Yeah, you were nailing that stuff.
Yeah, so some of the European names I can nail, and then others I blow horribly. But one of the names we're going to get to in the latter part is a German name that you need. I'm going to just send it to you because I can't.
Hey, the way I figure, it's good to space out the names so one person isn't taking all of the hits for saying it wrong.
Listen. It's like, I think like. There's like, so the, like Recluse, like he's the best at like butchering pronunciations. But for me, it's sort of like, it's endearing because like the dude is smart.
Yeah, no, it's very endearing.
Like the dude's smart and he knows his stuff, but he's an autodidact. He wasn't like trained, like, you know, at least I don't think he was trained. Like he didn't go to like a finishing school for fuck's sakes, you know? Yeah. And a lot of times autodidacts, they won't get like certain pronunciations correct. And like, you know, like to me, that's fine. I mean, it's like Ed Opperman's production sucks. That to me, that's endearing. I love it. I love the fact that like,
so great.
I love the fact he'll be like talking on his Friday night show and there'll be like a commercial running under it and he won't know and going like, to me is like, this guy rocks. Like he's just like, I love Ed Opperman. Like I got into this stuff because like, he's the guy who got me into like the quote unquote parapolitics thing because
Through Opperman?
It was through Opperman. So like a little bit about like my path down this road was like I was doing a documentary in film school about a local conspiracy theorist. And I kind of got into like, cause I kind of was into conspiracy theories when I was in university, but I didn't really understand anything. Like I didn't read any literature or anything. I just like watched like a DVD. That's how old this goes back. You know, watching a DVD with my friends in like a dorm room. Whoa, the Illuminati, cool.
Like sub loose change type stuff.
Oh, dude, this was like waste. This was like, I don't even know which psychos produced this thing, but like, it had some really interesting things in it. It was like you know, like there was like this conspiracy current at the time where like everything was like connected, right? Like. The great overarching conspiracy in the early 2000s was the Bavarian Illuminati conspiracy, where the Illuminati controlled everything and there were satanic occultists. And like, hey, part of that's true. You know, like there are pieces of that I believe that are true.
Synchronicity, like
the secret, yes.
Like everything connected to everything thing. For the longest time, I thought that's what conspiracy theories were all about.
Right. Like the master plan almost, right? And like you realize this, that kind of you grow into this stuff that it's a lot of just different groups of assholes doing horrible things across the planet. And sometimes they're working together, but often they're not. And they're all horrible assholes though. And some of them are into black magic. Some of them aren't. You know, like Le Cercle, they don't like, you know, meet in robes, but they probably killed more people than like the Golden Dawn. Right. So it's like, you know, people, I think there needs to be that context there as well. Like just because you're doing spooky things doesn't mean you're like the worst person who's ever lived. I think there is something to be said for those groups and their reach though, and what they've done to the culture. And I mean, that's a conversation for another time though, but they do link into this conversation. Yes. But yeah. So anyway, I got into like that, and then I started like researching there was a local guy who I heard on the radio once who was screaming about the Prince of the Power of the Air. And I was driving home from like a party. He's like laughing my ass off because this guy was out of his mind. And I interviewed him and he was a nice enough fella. And then I found out he was a Coast to Coast guest a few times. And, you know, I learned my lesson about that from there. I got out of conspiracy theories completely after that kind of like experience. And then the point being is it's like through that, I got into Opperman, and like through Opperman, I got into like all of you guys, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, he was kind of like the place, he was the middle spoke or the middle of the wheel in a way. And like everything kind of led from Opperman to like, you know, SJ, and then from SJ, I got into you. And so like, it was like this like cruel, like, because you guys are doing stuff like that I really like respect. Like the work you're doing is, it's interesting. It's, but like you're coming from it from, first of all, a leftist point of view, which I mm-hmm. found the conspiracy fear was completely right wing. And that was a yeah. huge turnoff for me. You know, it was just like a lot of like neo-fascist douchebags talking about Jews. And I wasn't into that. You know,
no, it's like we're trying to get back to the 60s and 70s, or yes. maybe more like the European like conspiracy theory culture.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why, like, yeah, like I love the stuff that you guys do. And like you guys, SJ, Opperman, and Recluse, those, you guys are my go-tos. So mm-hmm. like cheers, and I just want to say thanks for all the good times.
Thank you.
A lot of long drives listen to you guys, you know. So
yeah, no, for sure. Like,
yeah,
it's been very fun.
Yeah, I can imagine you've met some really interesting and crazy people. And if you have any questions for me afterwards about the weird stuff I've been involved with this show, yeah, some of the people I've talked to, like I'll answer any question you have. Yeah. But back to the, so see a little recap about the Templars. You know, in the 11th, sorry, recap on the Templars. In the 12th century, you know, King Baldwin II gives the Templars the Temple Mount. And for about 60 years, they, you know, rule from Jerusalem in a way, like they're guarding pilgrims. They come in. Saladin kicks them out around the, you know, the later part of the 12th century. And then for about 100 years, they're sort of bumming around the coastal regions. And while they're doing that, they're creating a massive financial empire in Europe. Right, and a financial, banking, landowning empire, and they're doing this all because the Pope has given them basically complete run of the place. The only body that the Templars answer to is the Pope himself. No one else, not the kings, not the queens, no one else. It's the Pope. So they have the run of Europe.
Yeah, which, like, even that functionally, like, if you're answering to just the very top, you're effectively not answering to anyone either, you know?
Exactly, exactly. So we are now in 1306, and King Philip the Fair of France, King Philip IV of France, he's broke, and the first thing he does is he banishes all the Jews, and he confiscates all of their property and goods. And...
real quick question, is that, like, for a region, or is that like across
all of France?
Dang, that's crazy.
It is crazy. It's insane. It actually is insane. So he also bullies a lot of Lombardian or like Lombard bankers as well, or Lombard merchants. And he takes their money as well, but that's not enough, right? He's still desperate for more money. So while this is going on, he's sort of pondering what he's going to do. And he notices that Mr. de Molay is looking for a new crusade. So King Philip, being the devious bastard that he is, comes up with, well, this guy's got a lot of money and I owe them a lot of money.
What's that quote? Like, if you owe me, like, or, you know, like, then it's your problem.
Oh, yeah. Geez.
Anyway.
Yeah. The thing is, if you're the king of France and you owe the bank money and you have an army, right?
It's the bank's problem.
It's the bank's problem. And it becomes the bank's problem. And a little like little insight into who Philip is. Like he's just done an ethnic cleansing against an entire population of his people, the Jews of France, for their money, right? This guy is a monster. And you can see this in how he interacts with the popes, okay? So Philip was ruthless in a way that other medieval kings just weren't. He and Pope Boniface the Eighth did not get along at all. Pope Boniface had him excommunicated. Philip followed that up with having his henchmen kidnap and beat the Pope basically to death. Okay, like this guy was legit evil. Which, so,
can I just say as a side note, like,
yeah,
I have a very Anglo history focused background, like growing up, and so right. like. All the stories of like Henry VIII, where it's like, oh, he didn't get along with the Pope. How crazy is that? And it's like, Philip IV murdered a Pope.
Oh,
and you never hear that part. Like,
Jimmy, it gets better for you then.
Yeah.
Because he murdered another Pope. He murdered Boniface's successor, Benedict the 11th. So he murdered murdered Boniface's successor, Benedict the 11th. And the thing with that is, like, Benedict XI died under mysterious circumstances, but a lot of people believe Philip had him poisoned, right? Because what happens in 1305, there's a new pope, Clement V. And the thing with Clement V is he's kind of known throughout history as one of the weakest popes. Like, he's kind of like a pathetic lackey to Philip.
He doesn't even lift.
He doesn't lift. This guy does not live the iron lifestyle. He hasn't taken the iron pill. And Pope Clement V is kind of like pathetic, and he's Philip's lapdog. It's so pathetic that Clement V ends up like leaving Rome. He never goes to Rome.
Oh, is this the period where,
Yes, it is. It's the quote unquote Babylonian captivity. So Philip has the Pope move to Avignon, France to keep an eye on him. Okay. This is how in the pocket Clement is. It's pathetic. Like, this guy is 100% like his creature. So now remember, the Templars answer to nobody but the Pope, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the Pope is now the creature of the King of France, what does that say for the Templars?
Mm.
So the richest, most powerful, you know, biggest group in all of Christendom, what does that say for them? So soon after Clement's comes into power in 1305. You have 1306, the expulsion of the Jews and the confiscation of all their properties and goods. Philip is still broke. Then in 1307, he starts kicking up dust about the Templars.
Hmm.
He has his lawyer, a man named, Guillaume de Nogaret. So I think Guillaume de Nogaret. I think that's what I'm going to say. Guillaume de Nogaret.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Philip starts kicking up dust with the Templars, little rumors here and there, you know, a whisper campaign. The Templars are doing heresy. The Templars are homosexuals. They're doing idol worship. They're into witchcraft. And there's like this sort of like whisper campaign among the French nobility about the Templars starting up, thanks to Philip and his agents. Chief among them is his lawyer, Guillaume de Nogaret. I believe that's how it's pronounced. If it's not, sue me. It's rumored that Guillaume has Cathar heritage, and it's at least according to the Templar fan fiction, he has Cathar heritage, which would kind of like, you know, give him a motivation of why he's so anti-Templar, because of course the Templar conducted a crusade against his people.
Interesting. Like the concept of like a hidden enemy, almost like a Frankist or like
some right.
sort of. Now right. It wasn't Philip IV who did that against the...
No.
That was like prior.
The Cathar Crusade was the Languedoc Crusade, as it's called.
Hmm.
Let me find out when that was. Because I think it was probably like Philip's dad or something.
Mm-hmm.
The Albigensian Crusade, sorry, that's what it's called. The Albigensian Crusade.
Oh, I've heard of that. Okay, yeah.
So this is about 100 years before what's happening here. So the Albigensian Crusade happens in the Languedoc region of France against the Cathars. It's about 100 years before the events of Philip and what's going to happen to the Templars. But the Templars were involved in this, and it's said that Philip's agent, this Guillaume character, was of Cathar heritage, or at least from this region. And he did not take too kindly to the Templars. Of course, we are still very much in the age of legend and, you know, myth and rumor, and historiography has not it's not perfect. So this is, you know, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. This is kind of like one of those things. Mm-hmm. It's good for the story, right? So things start heating up, and Philip is accusing the Templars now of usury in public. He's saying these guys are usurious. They, you know, I owe them money, but they're, you know, they're putting interest on it. How dare they? You don't do that to Christians. And so it gets, it's,
which, like, I should say for my listeners who don't know, usury was functionally illegal in Europe at this time, yes, which is like the practice of loaning money and charging interest.
Exactly. So he's charging the temple. This is a very serious charge, right? Mm-hmm. But the tensions are growing. It's getting so bad that Pope Clement V invites Jacques de Molay and the leader of the Hospitallers to come meet with him in France in 1306. Because he wants to make a proposal to the Templars. And this proposal is that the two orders will merge, mm-hmm, right? So the Hospitallers and Templars will merge, and Philip will become the new Grand Master of both. So the Templars are beat, like, they're beside themselves at this.
What's that meme? It's like, trade offer.
Yeah, trade offer.
I receive both orders, you receive nothing.
Yeah, you receive nothing. So the Templars are going to lose. They're going to lose their perfect gift, right? Where the, when, you know, like, a, you know, a few hundred years prior, the Pope gave them, another Pope gave them like complete domain over Europe. They're losing that. They're losing their authority. They're going to lose everything now. So Jacques de Molay is, you know, he's kind of like history's loser here. He just got the job and now he's going to lose everything. So he rushes to France trying to like mediate the situation. While he's doing that, Philip's agents are across France, kicking up even more dirt on the Templars. They're trying to find anything they can. Supposedly, Philip has his own agents join the Templars to get more dirt on them. Ooh. And through these infiltrations, you start having these crazy rumors starting to brew, right? The Templars are spitting on the cross. They're worshiping severed heads. Mm. There's these swirling rumors about some creature called Baphomet, this like demonic god that they're worshiping. So you have all this stuff kind of coming to a boiling point. Then in 1307, Philip invites Jacques de Molay to become a pallbearer at his sister's funeral. What an honor, right? So, yeah. So Jacques probably thinks that this is like, okay, things are chilling out. I'm going to the funeral. This is going to normalize relations. Everything's cool. Wrong. Wrong. Philip set him up. So Philip did this because he wanted to know where Jacques and his boys were going to be.
Well, no, I was just saying, like, what is this? The Game of Thrones. Was it the wedding?
The red wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's the white funeral. So it said that on it's like, I think it's October 13th. You know, the infamous, it's Friday the 13th myth, right? That Friday the 13th is a day that Philip drops the hammer on the Templars and across France.
Is that where it originated from?
Supposedly. I don't really buy the myth. I don't, because, but that's where the myth comes from. Then on Friday the 13th, Philip drops the hammer on the Templars and they just start arresting Templars all across France.
Interesting. Right? Wait, so is this Order 66 from Star Wars?
Execute Order 66. Pretty much. Because, in it, right, so, I mean, George Lucas, like, it's poetry, it rhymes. So he totally, like, got, like, you know, the Templars are, of course, in, you know, they're analogous to the Knights, to the Jedi Knights, right? And Philip, I guess, is playing the Emperor Palpatine role at this moment. He's doing his Order 66, and across France, Templars are being arrested. They're being arrested in their dozens. It's like the, it's crazy. In the roundup, of course, they grab Jacques. And his posse while they're en route to Paris. So when these orders are given, Templars across France are just rounded up. About 500 Templars in the initial roundup are arrested. Mm-hmm. Now, once they're arrested, it's not like they're given like, oh, you know, they're read their Miranda rights. No, they are taken into horrible dungeons and tortured. So... you know, and in some cases, these guys are just outright killed. Of the 500 that are captured in the first round, 138 confess to crimes from, you know, witchcraft, to idolatry, to homosexuality, to, you know, things that don't even like, you know, like adultery, even like these things that don't even like really register in like the contemporary mind of like what a crime would be. And this is where like history takes like, there's like three buckets we can place history now from the Templars. There is, you know, the first bucket is what we know. So what we know is the Templars after 1307 basically ceased to exist. Okay. It's about 7 years before Jacques is finally killed. But in this period, the Templars are rounded up in first in France. Then the kings of Europe start following through as well, because Clement will sell them out across Europe. And of course, the kings of Europe want that Templar. They want that Templar money too, right? So there's what happens to the Templars. What we know is that they disappear from history, and in certain places they rebrand, in other places they are morphed into the, you know, different orders like the Hospitallers. Then there's kind of like, you know, the normie conspiracy theories. And that's, we'll get into those. And then there's the way out there stuff, which I can't wait to talk about. So I think first we should probably talk about some like the more mainstream conspiracy theories, what happens after the Templars are kind of put under the boot by Philip and they're erased from history. So I think the first one to talk about is the curse of Jacques de Molay.
For my listeners, the probably the only thing I know about Jacques de Molay in general, other than what we just talked about, is Walt Disney was a member of the youth group. I forget, it was the something de Molay.
Oh, I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was a member of that group.
Let me see. It was the, it's just called Of de Molay, I guess. Interesting.
Well, Jacques de Molay becomes like a romantic figure after his death, like, because he does break under torture and he confesses to a number of horrible crimes, including blasphemy and idolatry, but he recants his confession in public. So in 1311, he recants his confession completely. So Philip is back to square one with this guy, right? Because
he's going back to the old me.
Yeah. 4 years after you just tortured and beat a man and like ripped all the skin off of his back to get this confession out of him. Now he's in public saying, no, I am not this. This guy's lying. but it didn't matter because in 3 years, in 1314, they build a pyre in Paris and they burn Jacques. They burn him up. And now there are a few different like tellings of this killing. So it happened in this like little, like I don't know if you've ever been to Paris, if your listeners have ever been to Paris, but there's like these little islands, between, you know, the river, like, and one of these little islands is where Jacques de Molay was burned, and you can visit it to this day. There's a plaque that shows, you know, Jacques de Molay, you know, it says it in French, of course, Jacques de Molay was like, you know, killed here. And supposedly a lot of occultists like going there. So hint, hint. But the thing is that it's a very famous place in Paris. You can go, you can see, you can take photos. Please do. Paris is a beautiful city. Have fun. Now, there's various accounts of what happened here. One account is that they gave Jacques the slow death. The slow death is when you kill someone with really dry wood. And because you burn to death, right? It's painful. It's
excruciating. Then you don't get the smoke, right? So you
exactly.
don't like,
There's dry wood or there's green wood, right? And if the king really hates you, you get the dry wood. If it's a more gentle death, you get the green wood. So you die from the smoke inhalation, or you die from the smoke. You know.
Yeah.
So supposedly Jacques got the dry wood, and as he's burning up, one account is that he screams a curse at the king and Pope Clement, right? So the other version is he just died in dignity. So, you know, depends what you want to believe there. With that said, a few months after Jacques' death, Pope Clement V dies. Just drops dead, okay? Drops dead.
Interesting.
While his body is in state at a church, a lightning bolt hits it and the church goes up in flames.
Damn.
Scorching his body. Gone.
Damn.
Dust. Right? And then a few months after that, King Philip the Fair is out hunting with his, you know, his group. He's having a great time. A relatively young guy for the time. You know, he's in his 40s. And he drops dead from a stroke. He's done. Gone. So within about 6 months of Jacques de Molay dying, you have the Pope who condemned him and the King who condemned him dying. So that is sort of like the first sort of like conspiracy, like kind of myth and legend about Jacques de Molay and his curse. And I think there's something like, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the church lighting up just like a funeral pyre. That's very,
quite poetic. It's quite poetic. And again, like we are dealing with a time where like history and myth kind of are interchangeable. And we do know that Pope Clement does die shortly after Jacques de Molay dies. Did the church burn up? I don't know. Does it make a great story? Absolutely. And that's why historians, I think, went with it.
Yeah, but I imagine that is like probably more substantiated, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah. I can't imagine that, like, that's completely in the realm of myth that like a whole church got lit up.
I think it's important, like, yeah. You know, like we haven't really delved into like the really like, you know, quote unquote sus stuff yet, but yeah. Like, you know, this is weird. All right. This is weird. Now the next kind of like conspiracy around the Templars is what happens to the Templar treasure, because supposedly the Templars had this like massive treasure of not only gold, but of knowledge and of like artifacts and of relics, right? Mm. Supposedly they have the piece of the true cross, the spear of Longinus, you know, the spear of destiny. They have, you know, like pieces of like the Ark of the Covenant or what have you. Like, supposedly they have this amazing treasure that like they've been coveting for all these years. And it's said that after the, you know, King Philip puts the hammer down, 1307, that a Templar treasure fleet off harbor at La Rochelle leaves France and makes its way either to Scotland, England, and some people think they made it to the New World.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Oak Island thing comes in, right? Like,
yeah,
there are people who believe that the Templar treasure is currently in Oak Island. And I have my beliefs about this theory.
What are your beliefs about this theory?
I believe that the treasure of Oak Island is the fact they've got about 10 seasons out of the myth of Oak Island. I don't think there's anything there. Listen, it'd be cool if there is, right? But I just don't see Mediterranean style galleys making that trip. Especially if they're heavily laden with treasure. I just don't see it. Like maybe they went to like, you know, other places in Europe. I don't know. I just don't, I think it's cool. I think it's like, I guess a romance, right? But it's not really something I buy into.
Yeah. I mean, they certainly wouldn't have like made it knowing where they were going.
No,
like they not on purpose. Right. Like,
no. And I've read theorists claim that, you know, the Templars went to Africa, South America, interacted with the Aztecs, all these, you know, crazy claims. And it's just like, I don't see it. I mean, it'd be cool if they did, but I just don't see it. And if people have evidence, cool. I love it. But for me, Oak Island, it's kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
But then like I don't really buy it. Then of course, like the other kind of more plausible thing is like that the Templars went to Scotland and helped Robert the Bruce, you know, defeat the English at the Battle of Bannockburn, you know, and there's a few, I mean, okay, maybe. Maybe that's true. I don't see why not. I mean, Longshanks, he used Templars actually to defeat William Wallace. So, you know, maybe they switched sides after what happened.
Interesting, because I imagine that like they just individual Templars were probably all over the place.
Like, they were all over the place. They were all over Europe. Like, so I could see, like, you know, I could see that. I think that's a respectable one, and it leads into like the other one, which is the Born in Blood hypothesis put out by John J. Robinson in his book Born in Blood. And what he argues is that the Templars, kind of, remember, there was a lot of Templar Masons, and these Templar Masons and other Templars became the Freemasons. They slowly, so the Templars in Scotland and in England, and they just slowly kind of became, they went into like, you know, hiding, and they became Freemasons. Like, it makes sense in a way, right? Like, if you're hiding from authorities, you would need secret handshakes and secret codes and symbols and what have you to kind of survive and navigate this world.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, you know, it's an interesting idea. And there is something to be said for there being a relationship between Templars and Masons. The Templars used a checkerboard pattern in some of their settlements. So I've been to a Templar city, which is Tomar in Portugal. And in the center of Tomar, there's a checkerboard pattern, which is a Masonic symbol or a Masonic pattern.
Hmm.
If you look at the Templar battle flag, it's also kind of white and black. So there's that. So okay. There's also the idea of the Templars being connected deeply with the Temple of Solomon. So are the Freemasons, right?
Right. That's sort of the foundational myth.
Exactly. So the first Freemason said to be Hiram Abiff, who was the architect of the Temple of Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And the Temple of Solomon was built around 1000 BCE. And it said that Hiram Abiff, you know, through Hiram Abiff comes this tradition of the Freemasons, this Masonic tradition starts there. So what many people have argued is that the Templars, through their time at the Temple of Solomon, sort of absorbed or rediscovered these Masonic mysteries in the Holy Land, then brought them back with them to Europe. I think it's halfway there for me.
Yeah, I was gonna say laying it up that way sounds less outlandish than I initially thought it would, though I'm again not necessarily like sure, you know.
Exactly, and like to be sure, like there's also a lot of Masons who want to promote this concept, because what does that do for them? It gives them a lineage that goes back to the fabulous Knights Templar, right?
Yeah.
So in Freemasonry, in the accepted Scottish Rite, and also in the York Rite, you have various Templar degrees or groups. Like there's the Knights of the Rose Cross. Interesting, right? Knights of the Rose Cross. There's also the Knights of St. Andrew, and they both contain bylaws with references to the Templars. Then, of course, we have the Rite of Strict Observance in Germany, which is now defunct, but we'll get into them in a little bit. But the Rite of Strict Observance believe that they were in direct communication with hidden Templar grandmasters.
Yeah.
So, and these guys date back. These guys date back to the mid-18th century. So they believe that, you know, through this revealed knowledge through a Templar grandmaster, that the founder of the Rite of Strict Observance was named. It was a gentleman named von Hund. He was a baron. He wanted to create his own Germanic kind of expanded rite of Freemasonry. And supposedly he had an interaction with one of these hidden grandmasters. And, you know, that according to von Hund, of course, and that this, the mysteries of the Templars were slowly being revealed to him through this grandmaster, through his interactions. Funny enough, the Rite of Strict Observance would last till about 1782 during the Convent of Williamsbad, which was a giant conference of strict observance Masons. And at this conference, there was a lot of people who were involved in another secret society called the Bavarian Illuminati. And Adam Weishaupt and his minions basically tried to take over the group at this convention. And half of the Masons were horrified by Weishaupt and his plans, and they left in disgust and horror. They went back and they, you know, powdered their wigs some more and cried about it. Because they're like, oh, this Weishaupt wants to destroy all the kings and queens of Europe. This is devilish. And, you know, they were half right.
Do you think any monocles fell off their faces in surprise?
Monocles were popping. Monocles were popping. Wigs were being, like, you know, spun around. It was a whole thing, right? Because this is like, Weishaupt was a professor at canon law trying to, like, tell barons and princes what was what, right? He was like probably like 32 at the time or something. And he's like, I know better than you guys because I read, you know, Montague or something. Like, this is the kind of guy you're dealing with. And you know, a lot of like the higher, a lot of the members of the Writers' Room of Servants were not into that because they were conservative. They didn't like, they had nothing to gain from Vysop's worldwide revolution. They had everything to lose, in fact. So they weren't into that. But that's that with the strict observance, they kind of go away.
Let me ask you. So, okay, with the rite of, okay, I know without getting too sidetracked into Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. So there's in Freemasonry, right? There's three rites.
Yes.
Or would that be the
there's,
right way?
There's
to
three
say
degrees. So yeah. In Freemasonry, you have your base, which is the Blue Lodge, right? Yeah. So the Blue Lodge is 3 degrees. It's novice. Or it's novice, accepted Mason, and master Mason. So those are your 3 degrees in Freemasonry. And through each degree, you kind of go through like the story of Hiram Abiff, right? And the final piece, you relive Hiram Abiff's brutal murder. Fun. So after that, though, Masons in Europe got really bored, right? Because they wanted more. They wanted more mystery. They wanted more.
You need an expansion pack.
They want exactly so
some DLC.
They wanted some DLCs. So you have this like explosion in Europe of like these like added rites, you know. So you have the rite of like you have like Egyptian rites, and you have like, you know, chivalric rites, and you have the strict observance in Germany, and you have different rites popping up in France. Like one of them is the Scottish rite, funny enough, but it's not Scottish, it's French. Yeah. You know, that's Freemasonry for you. And of course, the Scottish Rite is huge in the United States. A big part of why it's huge in the United States is because of Mr. Albert Pike, who is a very bad guy.
I don't know if I told you, I recently did an episode on the Providence graphic novel by Alan Moore.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
It's not out yet, but he appears in the graphic novel like in a dream sequence, and like so like I really want to find a good biography of Albert Pike.
Albert Pike is a very hard research because like to really understand him, you need to read Morals and Dogma. And Morals and Dogma, they call it the they call it the doorstop. Like the Freemasons, like they make fun of it.
Yeah,
they call it the doorstop because it's like this like impenetrable tomb of like occultic knowledge written by like a Albert Pike's a pretentious dude. Okay. He's a Yankee who moved to the South and joined the Confederacy. So this is like the kind of dude you're dealing with here.
That's probably a very particular type of guy.
It's a kind of guy, right? And he wrote this giant tome of like knowledge, occultic Freemason knowledge. And I tried to read it and it's like, I can't. It's like, it's not for me. It's literally not for me. I'm not a Mason. Right.
I can barely read Eliphas Levy. Like I can't handle this.
Yeah. And Levy's like easy to read compared to Pike. I found it's like, you know, but the point is, it's like, he's a ponderous person and he's full of contradictions and he's not a very nice gentleman, to say the least. Like Pike's relationship with the Ku Klux Klan is, it's not really known, but it's there. He probably was one of the founding members of the Ku Klux Klan, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was a horrifying rate, like a horrifyingly terrible person. He was a horrible racist. Just a bad guy all around. And like, even if you don't believe the like the Taxol stuff, which I don't, he's still a bad guy.
What is that?
Oh my God, the Leo Taxol hoax. It's amazing. Oh, I love Leo Taxol. He's the best. So Leo Taxol was this French journalist who in the 19th century, he created this like, he loved to stir the shit with the Catholic Church mostly. Like he fucked her like jabronis.
This is sounding familiar. Yeah, go.
So he would like mess with them and it got so bad. He then decided like, you know what? I'm now going to fuck with them even worse. So he created this giant hoax around Freemasonry and he used Pike as like the grand architect of the satanic takeover of the world through Freemasonry. And it's like the Taxol thing is amazing because he even hired like a actress to pretend like she was a witness to like these satanic rituals that Pike was doing in North Carolina. Like I think it was like Charlotte, North Carolina or something was supposed to be like the epicenter of this cabal. Like or it's Charleston or something. It's one of the two. It's one of the two. So, according to Dick Taxel, this is like epicenter of this like satanic cult that's going to take over the world. And then he did this press conference where he invited all of the press in Paris to come to this. I think it was Paris to come for the final reveal. And he had one stipulation: leave your umbrellas and canes at the door. So all of the journalists come in, they leave their umbrellas and canes at the door. They come into the room, they close the door. Tax goes, it's all fake. This is an actress I hired. Albert Pike is not trying to conquer the world through Satanism. I fooled you all. The problem with the Taxel hoax is though, like, people were like, no, the real conspiracy is that they put you up to lying about this now.
Yeah. What better way to cover your tracks if you're trying to take over the world?
Exactly. Yeah. So the Taxel thing is like a good, like a, don't be goofy with the shit. Like, don't be goofy with it. Like,
this sounds like a Discordian. Like,
exactly. Yeah. Discordians. Like, you just like Hulk Hogan has it, like that tweet where it's like, you shot your, like, it's like, you worked yourself into a chute, you mark, or something like that. And that's what Taxel did. He worked himself into a chute. And don't work yourself into a chute. Don't be a jabroni. Come at this stuff with some seriousness and, you know, be real with it. And that's all I have, man, to say.
No, seriously, like, my whole, like, thing with this, it's like, I'm down to always talk about some weird esoteric shit.
Yeah.
But I get sometimes people are doing it just to tell ghost stories. That's
yep.
fine.
That's a big part of it for sure.
But I can't handle when people are just being marks about it. Like, I can't deal with it.
Yeah. Don't be a mark about it. And also, like, don't work yourself into a shoot. Meaning, like, hey man, if you think that the process search of the final judgment literally did everything.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you shouldn't be naming these people who are still alive because they could fucking sue you. Or if they are the people you think they are, they'll fucking kill you.
Yeah. If they all that literally stuff out, are half as powerful as you.
The only saying. Group I'm afraid of right now, like, I've dealt with is La Cercla, because they're still active. Hey man, you don't think those guys are having the time of their lives in Ukraine right now? All those old cold warriors, those like those walking, like, entombed horrors, like, from that era, like, those who are still alive, like, they're having the time of their lives. This is their wet dream come true. Like all of their dreams of funding, like, Gladio networks and, like, you know, giving money and weapons to fight the Russians is coming true. Like, this is what they've won their entire lives, these sick fucks.
And it's Ukraine is just like Gladio the country now.
It is Gladio the country. It's horrifying. And, like, people with, like, you know, there's so many liberals who are cheering this on. It's insane. Yeah. Like, you know, like, listen, I don't want to get too political right now, but, like, I don't want a war. I don't like war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it. And I think that people who are cheering this on are insane, and this might lead to the destruction of humanity. So let's not do this. How about that? How about cooler minds prevail? Let's make a deal and go back to peace so we can all just chill. I mean,
I think that we all need to chill. Amen. So forget Pike, not forget, but, like,
mm-hmm.
So what was the right of strict observance, like, actually speaking? What did the right entail?
So, from my understanding, the right of strict observance was, I don't really know. It was supposed to, like, a very kind of, like, Catholic version of Freemasonry, because, like, remember, in the continental, like, Freemasonry, a lot of them were Catholic. Like, France mm-hmm. had tons of Masons, and they're Catholic. The Carbonari, a lot of them were Freemasons. Like, Italy, the Italian tradition of Freemasonry, you know, they're Catholic in Italy, and there is a deep tradition of Freemasonry in Italy. So it was, I think it was, like, kind of like the Catholic answer to, like, the Scottish Rite or the York Rite, you know. As far as what they did, I couldn't tell you. I don't know what their rites were. I don't know what they were up to. I'm sure it was really boring.
Yeah, I just looked it up. Not to, like, mm-hmm. but
no, please do. Please go for it.
I guess, well, mind you, this is Wikipedia, so Lord knows, who knows, but like it said that it was sort of like a, almost like a proto-national, like German national pride type of thing.
I could see that. I could see
but
that.
But then linking into the quote unknown superiors, kind of like the hidden masters, of course.
Yes. And the hidden masters is such an important thing because the hidden masters is a motif that pops up in almost every single secret society in the West. Yeah. So one of the most interesting things about these secret societies is the concept of the hidden masters. Like, where does it come from? So from the right of strict observance, we see it. We see hidden masters in theosophy. Mm-hmm. You know, Madame Blavatsky is communicating with these like perfect beings. Okay, who are they? What's going on here?
And like half the time they're like in Tibet or like in Shambhala, right, or like in the middle of the earth or some shit. Like,
exactly. And then you have like, you know, the Rosicrucians with Christian Rosenkreuz. Like, who is he? He's not a real person. His name is Christian Rosenkreuz. Like, come on, he's not real. So like, who is he? Is he another hidden master? Then you have the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and Anna Springle. So who is Anna Springle? Was she a real person? Supposedly she was in touch with the hidden masters, but there's no evidence that she even existed, right? So we have another hidden, quote unquote, hidden master. Then we're into, then we go into Crowley with his like communications with IWAS and everything else, right? Who's IWAS? What is IWAS? What is going on? I don't know. and so we have this long tradition of this hidden master, the hidden masters.
I mean, you know, even QAnon, who's Q?
Oh, Q is a hidden master.
Yeah.
Right. Q is a hidden master. It's Q is revealing occultic information to his followers. Right. Q is a hidden master. So through these cults, and Q is a fucking cult, you have these, what it really is, in my opinion, is a cutout. Right. There's no master. It's just the people wanted to create something that people could project authority onto, a perfect being that cannot be questioned.
Yeah.
If you don't know who that person is, you can't find their flaws.
And right? So, like, then you can avoid the blasphemy element of making it a religious thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that's a part of it, but
yeah,
you know, when looking for who the hidden masters are, and remember, Von Hund believes that he is in communication with the hidden Freemason, which I find very interesting. I'm not the hidden Freemason, sorry. Von Hund believes he's in communication with the hidden Templar Grand Masters, which is pretty interesting, right? What other group had hidden masters that had connection with the Templars? The Assassins, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the Assassins are, you know, that's a whole thing, right? With Shia Islam, they have these hidden Ayamans and the Mahdi and all these different kind of like hidden spiritual and secular leaders that will pop up and guide, like, you know, humanity at certain times. So maybe it comes from there. I don't know.
I was going to say, like, I'm no expert, but like that just feels like if the concept of hidden masters comes from somewhere and it's like a meme in the sense of like the idea, like, then of course it makes sense that like they would pick that up from the Crusades, essentially, like their time being like exposed to the Assassins, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, people have this like idea that the Templars and Assassins were always at each other's throat, and like they weren't.
Yeah.
There's moments where they were allied. There's moments where they weren't. The Assassins paid the Templars basically protection money at one point. So they were kind of like, you know, we'll get into Idris Shah. Like, Idris Shah believed that the Templars and the Assassins were basically two like arms of the same body. They were the same order, but different, like, you know, with a different paint, with a different coat of paint, right? Or a different religious outer coating. And what was that one order? It's like where this is kind of going. And like, you know, I can talk about like Roseland Chapel or the Priory of Sion, but I think those things are kind of done and boring. Like, for me, they don't connect.
Ah, I die, the innocent. What a sorrow with an ear to the God of God, the bull, the art assassin, and the king. Alaskan descendant with giant dagger, killed by a Templar.
Getting at is that there is this, the third bucket about the Templars, which I said is the weird stuff, is that there is a deep occultic knowledge regarding the Templars, and that is that the Templars were Gnostics, and that the thing they picked up in the East was Gnosticism. And this kind of idea of like this, the Gnostic Templars and their relationship to the assassins, who are said to also have like Gnostic ideas, right? All of this sort of connects with the idea of Baphomet.
Yeah.
So what is Baphomet? This is the big question.
I think like my listeners should probably, like, for this stage of what we're talking about, they should probably not think of the statue.
Don't think of this. Well,
we'll get to it. We'll circle back. Right?
We'll circle back to the statue, but do not think of the statue. I will read you what the Templar version of Baphomet was.
Go off.
The Templars were accused of worshiping a three-faced cat, or the face of a woman, or the face of a man, or the face of a multi-faced man. All these things were said to be Baphomet. So in general, Baphomet, as a Templar version of what Baphomet was, according to King Philip's agents, was a head. Okay, it was a severed head. It could have been a cat face. It could have been a three-faced man. It could have been a three-faced cat. It could have been a woman. We're not sure.
Like a sphinx-sounding thing almost.
Right. Yeah. So the concept of Baphomet, or Baphomet, as some people call it, I call it Baphomet because, you know, it's kind of what I grew up with. It changes depending on which Templar's confessing to it, but what doesn't, what doesn't change is the fact that it's a head. Now, what is Baphomet? So you have, now, throughout history, then you have Eliphas Levi, and you call him Eliphas Levi or Levi?
I don't know how you actually say it, but I don't.
How would you pronounce it?
Eliphas Levi? I don't know.
Yeah, Levi. Let's call him Levi. So you have Eliphas Levi's version of Baphomet, which shows up in about the 1850s. And his version of Baphomet is a composite figure. You guys know it. You love it. It's the spooky devil guy, you know? Like
the androgynous, like.
Yeah. And that creation. So we often associate that thing with the devil, right? Like it's a little bit more complex than that. It is androgynous. It's man, it's woman, it's man, and it's animal. It's holy and it's profane. It is a Gnostic, it's kind of a Gnostic symbol because it's both. It's all of it, right? So Levi takes the idea of Baphomet with the Templar's head, and then he changes that from this multi-headed faced thing into that spooky goat guy that the, you know, church of, was it, what are they called, the Temple of Satan or whatever?
Yeah they're always trying to put those up all over the place.
So like, you know, that's kind of what, so that is what Baphomet is to us. What it was to the Templars, or the people accusing the Templars of heresy, was very different. It was a severed head with different faces. But Levy then takes that concept and makes it a Gnostic creation.
Yeah, and he's doing, again, creative fan fiction. He's basically like inventing a different history than the one that actually existed, which is like very curious, obviously. Well, let me ask you this. Like, okay, like, I know a lot of people in general think forced confession under torture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No reason to believe any of it.
Right.
On the flip side, some people, maybe by inclination or politics or something, might think you can believe forced confessions under torture, especially if they all confess to the same thing, you know.
Right, right, right.
Depending on your inclinations, you can either very believe or very disbelieve the results you get. But my question is basically, like, what are we to make of any of these accusations that Phillips' agents found? I know that's a very hard question.
It's a very hard question, and I don't think we'll ever really know the answer because it happened 700 years ago. But I think that I'll get to it in a second.
Yeah.
Because there's something. So yes, all the confessions were done under torture. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something there.
Yeah.
There's a there. And I think it's important to kind of explore that there. It's important to explore that. And now you have, you know, what is Baphomet? So different people have different ideas what Baphomet is. You have Levi's version of Baphomet. According to Idris Shah, Baphomet was a, Arabic word meaning father or understanding, Adfomat, something like that. Like, and then you have, you know, Evola even had a take on it, you know.
Oh, I'm sure he would.
Yeah, of course he had a take on it. So I'll read from Evola.
Okay.
Which is something I never thought I would say. The central ritual of Templar initiation was kept very secret. From the proceedings of the trial, we learn that a knight who underwent it returned as pale as a corpse, with a lost expression on his face, claiming that from on he could never be happy again. Shortly after, the same knight fell into a state of invincible depression and died. What produces an extreme terror in some knights and causes them to flee? It's the vision of an idol, the Baphomet. So that's Evola's take on it, right? But Evola, again, he's reading from the confessions drawn from King Philip, right? Again, are those confessions real? Can we trust those confessions? Well, during my research into the Templars, I found something very odd. I was a believer that it was all BS, like that there wasn't a there, that Philip was just like, you know, getting his money. And that could be true.
Like whatever the truth of it, he absolutely like had an agenda. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely had an agenda. And he is the bad guy in that piece. Okay. Mm-hmm. With that said, I did find something very strange.
Yeah.
The Templars often use a seal of Abraxas.
Okay. All right.
So for those that don't know, Abraxas is a Gnostic symbol. It has the head of a chicken and the two snakes as feet, the body of a man. One of the arms is holding a shield. The other is holding either a flail or a sword, some sort of weapon. So it's a very strange looking symbol. It's a very Gnostic symbol. So like if you were to like Google like Gnosticism, it's one of the first things that shows up. If you were to go onto Wikipedia, it is the image they use for Gnosticism. Like,
oh, really?
It is. The
interesting.
Many groups who are Gnostic adjacent or Gnostic use the symbol. So, for instance, the OTO uses Abraxas in their Gnostic Mass. And so it is... It's there. They used it. Now, of course, there is an explanation. You know, there's a rational explanation for this, of course, which is that, hey, they're in the East. And the Christians in the East use a lot of Gnostic symbols because that's where Gnosticism was popular. And one of those symbols they used was Abraxas, but their version of, you know, this Gnostic symbol was, you know, related to God. Well, yes and no. Remember, the Gnostics were heretics, right? So it is odd that the Templars, who were, you know, the Roman Catholic Church's military wing, would be using this Gnostic symbol on like their seals. It's odd. Mm-hmm. I was reading a book by Tracy Twyman, yeah, about the Templars and Baphomet, and I think you take everything Tracy says with a grain of salt, because, like, you know, like, I mean, in the foreword of the book, she claims that she had, like, was psychically attacked after a interaction on a Ouija board. So, like, this is kind of like the world we're dealing with. Like, it's we're going into some very strange woo-woo stuff.
Yeah, she was saying that she was communicating with Baphomet.
Yeah, bad idea, right? So she links Abraxas and Baphomet, right? So mm-hmm. Abraxas, Baphomet are kind of, to her, they're linked. And her understanding of Baphomet was according to her, after she had a book by an Austrian quote-unquote Orientalist, Joseph von Hammer Purgstall, translated into English. According to her, the Templars were members of an Ophite Gnostic cult. And the Met in Baphomet is a Greek word that comes from wisdom. So she believed, and from this book, that Baphomet was an allusion to the Gnostic rite of Baphometes, or baptism of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is interesting. It's a very interesting idea. You know, Abraxas is found, again, he's found all over Eastern Christianity. He's found in Gnostic Christianity. Today, there are many groups, for instance, out of Malta, with the name Abraxas attached to them. There is, if you just Google, you know, companies with the name Abraxas, there's Abraxas Security. There's all sorts of different, you know, Abraxas adjacent groups. So it's an interesting name. The K-pop band, what's the K-pop band?
BTS, was it?
Yes, BTS. Yes, the K-pop band BTS. They have like this whole like myth about Abraxas, like their BTS mythology.
Yeah.
So like there's something going on there, right? And it's
and also the movie Mandy mentions, yes, Abraxas.
Yes, it does. So, you know, with Abraxas, you're getting into some like weird mystical thing. So yes, the Templar used the Abraxas seal. That's a fact. They did. But what does that mean? Were they Gnostics? I don't know.
By the way, like, I just had a flashback to a while ago when I was researching some sort of like hedge fund or something that had, mm-hmm, like Maltese connections, and it was like, I think it had Abraxas in the name of, yeah, it too.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of companies have a lot of like weird companies out of Malta.
Yeah.
So if you want to get even like creepier, the Abraxas as a number is associated with the number 365, which is, you know, solar calendar. Then you get into the idea.
Is that through like gematria or something?
Yeah, through gematria, according to, right? So you know who else is really into Abraxas?
Who?
Carl Jung.
Oh, jeez.
Carl, of Abraxas, he wrote, before I read this sus as fuck Carl Jung quote.
It is funny how like everyone loves the hero's journey, Carl Jung and the archetypes, and it's just like, sauce. Dude was on some weird shit, man.
He was on some, Carl Jung was on some really weird stuff, and one of the weird things he was on was Abraxas. And like, so here's the quote. So the Carl Jung quote is, "This is a god whom ye knew not, for mankind forgot it. We name it by its name Abraxas. It is more indefinite still than God and the devil."
Interesting.
Yeah. So another fun thing about Abraxas is that he's often equated with the Archangel Michael.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I've heard some things along these lines.
So Abraxas connection to Michael's really interesting, because that leads us back to the Temple of Solomon. It was Michael who gave Solomon the magical ring, which had a pentagram on it, which enabled Solomon to command the 72 demons that built his temple.
And of course, the grimoires, the keys of Solomon, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
To this day, practitioners of magic will use things like rings or belts to bind demons. So this is a to command them, angels and demons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thing that goes back to, you know, Solomon, supposedly. And remember, this is all taken from the, you know, the Testament of Solomon. I think it's the Testament of Solomon or the Book of Solomon, which is sort of a, it's not in the Bible, but it's, you know, it was one of the books that didn't make it.
Is it the Apocrypha?
Yeah, it's Apocrypha. Yeah. It's one of the books that just didn't make the cut, but it's there. It's in the ether. It's in like the Christian kind of like expanded universe, right? It's there. Christian Jewish expanded universe. It's there.
Yeah.
So you have this connection between Abraxas, the Archangel Michael, Abraxas, Malta, the Knights of Malta. Like, I know I'm doing a lot of like, you know, red stringing right now on like the conspiracy map, but there's a lot of connections. It's very strange. So we're moving on. Now, one of the books I read about the Templars, like I read a bunch of books, and most of them are pretty mundane. Like it just talks about like, the history of the Templars, and it's a very, you know, really interesting history. But one of the books I picked up was written by James Wasserman. And James Wasserman, he was really concerned with the connection between the Templars and the Order of Assassins. Now, for those who don't know, James Wasserman was a high-ranking member of the OTO. So we are dealing with an occultic-minded person. And this was his read on the Templars and what was going on. I believe the interpretation of the Order's guilt or innocence that is most consistent with historical evidence and with a common sense understanding of human nature suggests that an inner core of the Templars quite possibly subscribed to an echo of the behavior of which the Order at large was accused.
Interesting.
He then goes on to say, and these men, some of whom survived, were mystical channels by which Gnostic Ismaili legacy entered European occultism, where it has continued to influence the Western mystery tradition ever since. So this is an occultist thing, right? Like this is what he believes. And again, that's his opinion, but it's interesting, right?
Well, I would say too, I believe that Peter Lavenda himself, an occultist also in closer probably to the Wasserman position, mm-hmm. he fundamentally, I think, advocates the same belief.
Yes, and I believe Idris Shah also, like Idris Shah comes out right out and comes out and says it, that through the assassins, the Templars gained this Gnostic knowledge, right? Mm. The assassins are a whole thing, like that's a whole show unto itself. Mm. And you know what they like what they believed in and what they were about, it's very complex. And I did not read enough about the assassins to really give it a fair shake. All yeah. I can give you is sort of like what other people are saying. So moving on from, you know, like since we're talking with James Wasserman, who's a OTO guy, let's talk about the OTO.
Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about the OTO and some of like these new or rebirth Templar organizations. So the OTO is a German occult group that kind of came out of like the, they came out of the, Masonic traditions, okay, of the late 19th century. They're founded by German-speaking occultists, but they, and later, of course, they were kind of taken over by Crowley, like famously taken over by Crowley. And Crowley called the OTO an interpretation of the Templars. He said that they were the faithful knight monks of Thelema. And like that, the order is structured in a strict hierarchy, according to him, in military lines. I don't know if that's true. I mean,
if you were to try to make a bunch of poets into...
Yeah, if you're trying to, yeah. So one of the things the OTO does, of course, is they have their Ecclesiasta Gnostic Catholica, right? Like this is the Gnostic Catholic Church, and they have the Gnostic Math. They have the Gnostic Mass. And in the Gnostic Mass, they do use Abraxas imagery, as I pointed out earlier. And it's the same symbol that's used by the Templars, like the same kind of, the same guy on the Templar seal. You could see him in a Gnostic mass done by people of the OTO. So we're talking about Gnosticism and like this idea of Gnosis and what Gnosticism is. Jimmy, maybe you could hit Gnosis for us, because
I mean, it's like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it means knowledge in Greek.
It does. So Gnosis, like really what Gnostics are after is knowledge. They believe that through this knowledge, they can become, they can get closer to God, right?
It's basically like fundamentally like the Promethean approach to spirituality, rather than like, you know, more of a submission or like a aligning your will with God's.
Exactly.
The general, to be as broad as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Like Gnosis or Gnostics. So like there's Gnostics who believe that we live in a fallen world, the whole thing with the Demiurge, which is Abraxas, you know, the God of the Old Testament, who's actually an evil God. And Jesus was, according to Gnostic Christianity, at least, Jesus was here to kind of correct what the Demiurge, the God of the Old Testament, who's a failed God, created and bring us back to our true selves, which is a spiritual self. So our material world is evil. Knowledge, Sophia, is like the, from which all this is, our knowledge is born from, is also evil. Like it's all, everything's basically evil except for like the perfect being, be it Manichae or Jesus or whatever you believe in. Right. So
real quick, as a side note, how much do you personally feel comfortable with the fact that like a ton of the AI companies like to name themselves like Sophia or like make allusions to that shit?
Oh man, when you're getting, okay, it's like, if their understanding of Sophia is like a grade 9 level, like I took a class in, you know, classical, I took a class in history and Sophia is a cool name. Fine. Don't care. But if like, but I know about this shit now, it's like, it's a bit frightening, you know, because it's like these people believe that like, you know, the awful, like basically Sophia is the whore of Babylon. Like, it's scary. It's weird. It's like, you know, like these people actually, like Gnostic people, like people who actually really believe in Gnosticism, think that we're trapped in the matrix, right? That we're in a false reality.
You got to ask yourself, like, why does like the World Economic Forum and all these other like institutional organizations keep being like, damn, what if everything's just everything? What if we're in a simulation? It's not just Joe Rogan smoking weed bullshit. Like there are people who are specifically asking these questions for dark esoteric reasons.
Very dark esoteric reasons. And like the more I got into this, like the more I realized that like how dark these esoteric reasons were, right? Like, and a little bit about the OTO, like they're super into this, right? Like Crowley was super into this stuff. I don't think Crowley necessarily believed that we lived in a fallen world, like, but he was into Gnosis. So meaning that Crowley believed, like, you know, do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. What does that really mean? Instead of giving your will, instead of God being the active ingredient in your spiritual life, you are, right? So you think you're God, basically.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying. So when these people do magic, they're saying that I am the one who is affecting the world through spiritual means, not God. And that, I think that's kind of a freaky thing, right? Because through that you have like, I mean, what has our religion taught us about this? That humans have hubris, like this, this hubris that will end up destroying us.
Yeah.
And I got to say, it's like, it's pretty obvious that we're going down that path. And the Gnostics, I think a lot of them want that to happen, right? Like they want to uncreate the universe because it's not perfect.
Yeah, there is definitely an open question as to their motives and intentions.
And I'm not saying that like members of the OTO want to uncreate reality, but there are Gnostic groups that do.
I'm not saying that.
I'm not saying it either. I don't know what they want to do. I'm not a member. I don't know. They seem quite nice when you, yeah, but you know, who knows what their agenda is? It's like, do they want to uncreate reality?
I'm telling you, Monty, we got to do like almost like the AFA or something, like anti-Gnostic action.
Yeah, I'm definitely anti-Gnostic. I think that if Gnostics got punched, they would stop being Gnostics really quick. Like you are an animal. You're alive. You breathe. This is happening to you right now. Your life is happening. You will live. You will die. I'm sorry to tell you this. You are not some like heightened spiritual thing. It's you're here, man. Live with it. Deal with it.
Touch grass.
Touch grass. Touch grass, motherfuckers. You know, like, okay, did like, why is it that now all of a sudden that we're, you know, we're in a simulation? It's because computers exist now that we have the our dumb monkey brains can then contextualize that on top of like the computer, right? That's all it is. And it's like, but the sad thing is we are now building a world where we are becoming the demiurge. We are becoming Abraxas because we're creating things like Meta.
Mm-hmm.
We're creating these digital worlds, which will entrap people. So it is happening. We are doing it. So that is scary. Yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
I know. And that then you almost end up in a situation where like you get like Meta Gnostics who are trying to tear down the technological world in order to live in the real world. Like everything's like doubling back on itself.
Everything is. It's this really interesting like world we're in right now where it's like we have too many thoughts, not enough actions. And mm-hmm. I think that's a huge problem. Like we're not even really thinking. We're just posting. We're just saying shit. And the thing I find so interesting about like what the Gnostics are saying is that like these were like the learned people of their times. And we were talking about fan fiction.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about fan fiction for a second. Okay. Crowley and the Gnostics. So I don't believe the OTO is they're not Gnostics like the Cathars. They don't believe in a dualistic world. They're not Manichaeists, mm-hmm. but they do believe in Gnosis. Like that for sure. I know they do. Yeah. They believe that they can, to understand God, you need to be like God. They believe that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these L chemical ways of trying to create this Gnosis. And of course, since it's Crowley, it's all gross.
It's all drugs and different types of sex.
It's mostly just body fluids.
Yeah.
So if you take a look, like the audience at home, I want you guys to Google the Golden Dawn tarot card for temperance.
I'm going to do it right now.
Or a hermetic tarot card for temperance. Tell me what you see.
The one I'm seeing is, let's see, there's like a, what are they making? Like a lady making a brew. She's pouring some stuff in.
She sure is making a brew. What colors are the substances?
Yeah, that looks like a, what is that? Like a milky looking substance.
Yes, it is. Okay, so Jimmy, what do you see when you look at the Temperance tarot card?
All right, so I'm seeing a two-faced woman, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She's pouring something into like a cauldron. She's pouring two things, in fact. One is maybe like fire. Is she pouring? I can't quite tell. Mm-hmm. And the other one is a chalice with like a milky looking mm-hmm. substance going right into this cauldron.
So tarot is often considered like tarot is used, especially like hermetic tarot cards, like the Golden Dawn deck. It's often considered to be like a magical map, mm-hmm. right? So through the tarot, there's different magical symbols and things that are attached to it. It's also connected to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, the 22 trumps or the paths on the Tree of Life, the numbers, so 1 to 10 are the Sephiroth on the Tree of Life, and the different suits are the levels, kind of, you know, it's a 3D map of the Tree of Life. So, because you can be in like different places in the Sephiroth, different like levels of consciousness and what have you. So that card, Temperance, you're seeing a woman pouring two liquids into the cauldron. And this is the elixir of life. This is an alchemical thing that you're seeing. And this is supposed to be the elixir of life. This is the, you know, the great medicine of immortality, as they call it. And the order, the OTO, they do their own version of this called Cakes of Light.
Don't eat the Cakes of Light.
Do not eat the Cakes of Light. I don't know if I should tell your audience what's in the Cakes of Light, but...
Yeah, go for it.
Cakes of Light are basically the red substance you see is menstrual blood, or supposed to be menstrual blood. That's the fire. The white substance is semen. And in the Cakes of Light, you have a mixture of menstrual blood, semen, honey, cake batter, and olive oil, or any oil. And you mix those together and you have the Cakes of Light. Through these in the Gnostic Mass, that's their Eucharist. You eat that, you're supposed to help, it's supposed to help you achieve Gnosis, that oneness with God, becoming close to God. So we are dealing with, like, you know, weird stuff here. And there's so much cum eating.
It is the...
Like, you could cut this part out, but, like, man, sex magic is mostly about, like, it's not fun, right? Like, the lion-headed, like, so another Gnostic symbol of, like if you look at, it's the, it's a lion-headed snake, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's sperm. Like, that's a sperm. Like, that's basically what it is.
Isn't that, like, and isn't that image frequently the, like, the demiurge?
Yes, the demiurge is a sperm.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, it's all connected to sex magic and this, that, and everything else. It's all kind of weird and creepy. But, you know, and like, but I have a theory I want to shoot your way.
Okay. Hit me.
Right. I have a theory. So you have all these, so, okay. Actually, let me get into this like that. You have all these people who are into, like, the Templars Gnostic connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have Albert Pike, you have Crowley, you even have a Pope. Well, Pius IX thought that the Templars were Gnostics. And he was writing in, like, the 19th century because he's attacking a Neo-Templar group, saying that these guys are, there was a Neo-Templar group in France. They did this thing called Johnism, and Johnism is basically, or Johannism, which is basically believing that John the Baptist was the real Christ, and there were Gnostics. There's also a lot of John the Baptist stuff with Gnostics too. There's a weird connection between them and John the Baptist.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever picked up on that. I'm sure it's there, but, like, I've never heard about it.
Freemasons also really revere John the Baptist. Like, one of the first Freemason symbols is John the Baptist on one side. The other Saint John on the other, I forget which one. It's the last Saint John on the other, and there's a circle between them, and that's also represent like spring and winter, like the two seasons, or summer and winter, like the two seasons, and between them is us, you know, our lives. So we start off young, we end up dead, you know, old. So, like, it's an interesting symbology, but Pope Pius IX, like, he attacked this Neo-Templar group, saying, you know, they were heretics and they were this and they were that. And remember, this is, like, you know, this is the 1900s. By this time, nobody really cares.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, sorry. It's the 1800s, right? Like, no one at this time in the 1800s really cares. It's like, it's, they did their thing. They were in France. It was weird. But you have all these people kind of connecting the Templars to Gnostics and all this rich fan fiction, if you will, built around this.
Yeah.
Right? This really rich fan fiction. But my question is, what if they all got it wrong?
Yeah.
What if Western occultism is based on nothing but the false accusations from Philip the Fair? From Baphomet to all of it. Yes, the Templars did use an Abraxas seal. But they also used, most of their seals were crucifixes or the church, like the Holy Sepulchre, or they even used the crescent moon that the Muslims used, right? Does that mean they were Muslims? Some will say yes, but I don't, like, so are they Muslims? Are they Gnostics? Are they Christians? I'm starting to think that a lot of this, I think for me personally, the biggest thing about the Templars is that they created so much myth and so much, like, hype, starting from Bernard of Clairvaux to today. And they created this rich mythology that Western esotericism latched onto and grew from, but I'm not sure if there's anything there. And that means that Pike, Crowley, and all the rest of them got it all wrong.
Yeah. Well, okay. Like, let's think about this. There's virtually nothing to the Egypt stuff.
Nothing.
Like, we know for a fact that, like, none of the Egypt stuff is based in, like, anything
nothing
resembling reality or historical history.
No, it's all stuff that's based on basically fan fiction.
Yes.
Right? So, like, I hate to say this, but, you know, these people have put so much time and effort into this, like, great, wild, you know, cosmology that just doesn't, the pieces don't fit. And they're trying, so I have to believe now that Philip the Fair was telling the truth. But the thing with Philip the Fair is that he created this entire, him and his agents created this entire mythology of the Templars worshiping Baphomet. And from Baphomet, you have all this stuff. It's crazy. It's wild stuff. Remember, not one single one of these confessions jives. They all have a different thing of what Baphomet is. They all say something different what Baphomet is. Baphomet is, according to one Templar, it's a face with three heads. Another, it's a cat head. You know, it's like they can't get their story straight, right? Because they're giving you confessions that are torture.
It's kind of like, what was the name of the Albert Pike myth or the prank? Or
The Taxil hoax, right? So the more people want to believe it, the more it becomes true. Now, yeah. I'm not saying the Templars are not sus. There's some sus stuff there for sure. There's some really weird stuff with the Templars. I mean, they were a military order that had a lot of money, and with money and power came probably some crooked stuff. But the whole like hyper-Gnostic thing that a lot of occultists have built over the years surrounding the Templars, like I kind of want to burst their bubble now and say, I don't see it. I think that Philip the Fair created this that you guys latched onto, and then you built an entire universe around it. What if it works for you, whatever, right? That's your deal. But if you want to undo reality because of that, then I don't know, guys.
Yeah.
Find something else to do. As far as severed heads, the Templars did venerate severed heads. They did. And these were the severed heads of female martyrs. So they had the severed head of Saint Euphemia and Saint Ursula. Those were the severed heads that they found.
Interesting.
Right? Because that's what Catholics at this time and still do. They venerate body parts of saints. It's weird. As someone who grew up Catholic, I don't get it. I'm no longer Catholic. One of the reasons is, you know, creepy stuff like having the bones of fucking saints around. It's creepy.
Here's the finger of a martyr.
Here's the toenail. Here's the toenail of the greatest poster ever lived, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux.
What was I gonna? So okay, I might cut this little snippet, but like, you know, obviously Recluse, you listen to The Farm, right?
Yeah, I love The Farm.
Yeah, okay. What I'm trying to remember the term, like, for like when you sort of like meta create reality through like
egregore.
No, not egregore. No, egregore. It was the like John Carpenter in The Mouth of Madness, or is that right, the name of the movie? Like,
yeah. There's
some word for it where, and he uses it, I can't recall, where it's basically like you are knowingly creating false stories, and then those stories become real on a certain level. I wish I could remember the term.
Yeah, but it's like we it's a great term. It's like you're creating reality. You're forging reality, and I think that with a lot of like, you know, magic groups as well, they don't care about the truth or reality because that's a part of what magic is, right? It's you're doing your own thing. You're making your own reality. These people believe in creating gods, basically.
If you believe in creating your own reality, then you really wouldn't care about the historical veracity of a story you made up in order to create and effectuate your own reality.
And it's obvious they don't. And like, I mean, like, listen, you can cut this entire part if you want to keep the spooky like Gnostic stuff. I get that for the sake of the viewers the listeners. But like, I mean, I looked at it and I was just like, yeah, this is a cool story, but it's like the only evidence we have is Abraxas, which is used like across the world. So either Abraxas, listen, hey man, for all I know, Abraxas actually in their connection is a real thing, and that the Templars were worshiping a Gnostic demon. It's a possibility. Okay. I'm not saying it's out of the picture.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't know if I buy it because of how the confessions were won. I also, because none of the confessions are kind of like, they're not all saying it's the same thing, right? All these Templars who are confessing to it all say a different thing.
Yeah.
No one gets their story straight.
Well, that's the thing too. It's like, there's no reason to believe essentially a Satanist about the Templars being Satanists.
No. Why would I believe you?
Wasserman, Lavenda, like, they're like, you know, I kind of believe that maybe they were actually Satanists, or, you know, believed in they want to call Satanism.
Yeah, whatever they want to call it, right?
And it's like, but you do that. So
you do that.
I'm not going to, like, necessarily believe that.
It's the same reason why Von Hund wanted the Templars to be Masons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it added cachet to his group. It added that oomph, right? It adds something. It's I am now infusing my dinky group that was founded in, like, you know, 1905 with something that's more ancient and mystical. Because of that connection to the Temple of Solomon, it has even more oomph. That is what's going on, I believe. Like, I think that these people want to usurp the Templar mantle because it has that charge. And the Templars did not go away. That's a thing people have to understand too, is like, it's convenient for us to say that, you know, the Templars went away and then they disappeared. They didn't. They were integrated into the Hospitallers. Members in Spain and in Portugal, they just changed the name. Like they just changed the name of the group.
Yeah.
Because like it got to the point where, like, okay, the Templars have like cities in Portugal and Spain. We're going to change the name. So, you know, they didn't go away. Like, a great example of this is what happens in Portugal. So, and, you know, in the 1300s, the King of Portugal, King Denis, says, like, yeah, I like the Templars. I don't want to get rid of them. So the new Pope is like, fine, keep them. Just change the name. And they did. They kept their assets. They kept everything. Over time, that group of Templars in Portugal became very influential in the kingdom. And they became a little bit more.
What was the new order called?
They were called the Order of Christ.
Hmm.
Now, dear listeners, please Google the Order of Christ and tell me something, and then look at the names attached to that group. You notice something? You have people like Henry the Navigator, Vasco da Gama, Ferdinand Magellan. Interesting, right? So they exist to this day, the Order of Christ, to this day. They're still around doing their thing. It's mostly a secular group right now, right? Like, they're not, like, even at the time of, like, Henry the Navigator, they were mostly secular. They were they were kind of like the Order of the Garter in England. That's kind of an equivalent they kind of morphed into.
Yeah, well, the Order of the Garter is very interesting itself.
Oh, they are. But my point being is that they stopped being the holy knights and became a more secular military order. A military order that conveniently had the technology and the funds to travel across the globe in boats. It's interesting, like the Templars were the ones, like, or a Reformed Templar organization were the ones who traveled the world. They were the first to explore the ocean, in many ways, in European terms, right?
Yeah.
So, and then we also have what happens to, like, let's just stick with, like, Portugal for a moment, because this is a very fun piece. So, you know, okay, we have the Templars. The Templars, you know, they go on, become Hospitallers. Maybe they become Freemasons. Maybe they travel the oceans with the Portuguese. But what happens to the assassins, their buddies, their supposed Gnostic buddies through all this? So the Nazari Ismaili elite communities are basically destroyed thanks to the Mongols and various other, you know, happenings in the medieval and late medieval era. They go across the Middle East into India even, and they're kind of all over the place. Yeah. Then you know a little about the Aji Khan, right?
You mean the modern day?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I only know that they came up in my William Stevenson episodes, where William Stevenson went hunting with, I think, the third.
Yes, it was the third, because the fourth one is the current Aga Khan. So yes. In India, the Aga Khan became very close. This was back in the the whole Raj days. Mm-hmm. Let me get the exact date, because it's actually quite interesting what happens to the Nazari Ismailis, who are the assassins.
Oh no.
Oh, you're gonna love this part. This is fun. This is like I just went off about how like there's no like susness with the Templars. Oh no, there's something.
The Templars only happen to discover the New World functionally.
They only happen to discover the New World eventually. Also, Columbus. Columbus yeah. was educated in Lisbon at a quote unquote like an Order of Christ institution, the navigational school. So yeah, I mean, there's yeah, okay.
I was gonna say too. I'm sure that I've always wondered about like the conquistadors and like who they were, what they were about.
Yeah,
I wonder if they tie into that at all.
Listen, someone had to get John D. that Black Mirror, right? That's like someone had to go to the get that obsidian mirror, because European obsidian just wasn't cutting it at the time.
If I'm not scrying, I'm crying.
If I ain't scrying, I'm crying.
So it needs to make that Gnostic country song.
Yeah, I'm gonna do some an Enochian rap later. Enochian hip hop. My new group just does Enochian hip hop. We're badass. So anyway, okay. Look at the Aga Khan one. Can you look mm-hmm. at this guy?
Yeah.
Look at him. I'm a little. So take a look at this guy. Tell me what you see. So this is hardcore podcasting, folks. We're doing real life Google searches for you.
Hey, I do this so much less than most podcasts.
I know.
Just looking things up in yeah. real
time. No, you got your shit like on check. Like you got.
This is probably the episode where I know the least going in of yeah. anything I've ever done, probably.
Yeah, it's a wild ride I've taken us on. Hopefully it makes sense. So the thing I want you to look at is where he gets his governorship of basically all of India.
Governorship of Kerman?
So Bombay.
Okay.
Let me actually get the lawyer's name, because it might be, because there's a court case that's really interesting. So the Aga Khan becomes a political leader for the British Raj in India.
Mm-hmm.
A justice in India, Sir John Joseph Arnault, he gives the Aga Khan legitimacy. So in a court case, he says that the Aga Khan is the descendant of all the heirs of Alamut, so all the Alamut Imams. That Alamut was the capital of the Nazari Ismaili community. That's like the sacred kind of like fortress, the impenetrable paradise fortress created by the assassins. So he says that this Aga Khan guy is the legitimate descendant of the heir of the Alamut Imams. And thus he is a legitimate heir of the Fatimid Caliphate. And thus he is the legitimate heir of the Prophet Muhammad. So this was a court case that happened, and it gets even weirder, if you can believe that. So you know about Aga Khan number three hanging out with our good pal Stevenson, right?
Yes.
Because I'm just so the audience knows, I am currently broadcasting from Camp X.
Yeah.
just outside. They won't let me in. But
good Lord, this is what I get for not fully looking at at AK the third.
AK the third, Aghi Khan. I hope I'm saying his name right. You have to respect the Khan, you know, because he is the he is the legitimate descendant of the Fatimid Caliphate and thus the Prophet Muhammad, according to a British judge. So
it's like they were just like, damn, we got to do some British Israelite shit, but for the...
Oh, it is awesome. So remember, the assassins, this is the leader of the assassins. So the current leader is Aghi Khan the Fourth, and he's involved in all sorts of interesting things. There's the Aghi Khan Fund for Economic Development and many umbrella organizations. You know, there's all sorts of interesting things. He's giving scholarships to, you know, universities like Harvard and MIT. He's up to all sorts of interesting things. And where does he live? Do you know where he lives?
I know, because you've told me. Tell me where he lives.
He lives in Lisbon, Portugal, the same city where the Order of Christ / Knights Templar are located.
And then more specifically, where does he live?
So I had being a grotto head, I you know, and a man of many questions, I brought this question to the grotto, and our man Khalid was great enough to answer it, and he did some digging, and he found out that the Aghi Khan actually lives in the home of a former Grand Master of the Order of Christ / Knights Templar. And you can, it's, he does. It's wild. So listen, maybe I was wrong. Maybe going off about like this whole like weird Gnostic connection thing, maybe Idrisha was right. Maybe he was right. I don't know. It's weird.
I mean, so like just with the Knights of Malta, the different hospitallers with this guy, like, I'm like, it's almost like you almost had me with the whole, there's nothing going on here. And now I'm just back to just like glowing red eyes, like real shit.
There's something, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, it's like my logical mind says that, like, there's nothing going on, that, hey man, you know, like, rich guys just doing rich guy things, right? In Lisbon, Portugal, great weather, great food. Hey, man, you like the beach? You like culture? Why not? It's pretty cheap to live there. But then again, he's living in a Knights Templar house.
And it's like, there's no shortage of like spooky fascist, like magic shit going on.
No, no. And you know,
it's not like they had, you know, Gladio shit.
Or no, no.
It's not like they were
doing weird stuff with Le Cercle and that they were doing, like, you know, like the final heirs of the Habsburg dynasty trying to like collapse communism. No, they weren't involved in that. I think to leave the audience, like, I want to leave them with a question. It's always fun, right? To like leave people with a little questioning what's going on here. I don't know. Listen, I'm but a simple documentarian, as you could probably tell when I was struggling through all the history stuff. Like, I do my best to communicate what I know, and I probably got some details wrong, but the broad strokes are right, and the broad strokes are weird. And I would love people to dig deeper into this, but also dig smart. You know, because like, okay, dealing with the Templars, you're dealing with a group that's gone. They're 700 years ago, they're all gone. Order of Christ is mostly secular. It's like, I'm sure Cristiano Ronaldo will become a member of the Order of Christ eventually. And I'm not saying he's like, I mean, he's sus in his own ways, folks, but like, not like this kind of stuff.
You'll have to tell me later. I don't even know.
I'll tell you later. It's weird. But you know, whatever. What I'm trying to say is that like, there's something definitely going on with these groups. Was Idris Shell 100% correct? I don't know. Probably not. I think there's something there, though. I think that there's something definitely, there's smoke here. And if there's this much smoke, there has to be something. I don't know what it is exactly, but it is a it has been tickling my brain for a while. And that's why I kind of went down that weird Gnostic route, because when I found out like the connections between the Aga Khan and the contemporary Knights Templar, I was like, okay, so the Assassins and the Templars are still buddies. What does that say about what Idris Shah was saying? What does it say about what all those other occultic, you know, authors and writers and, you know, and occultists were saying? Fuck if I know. And I'm not joining the OTO anytime soon to find out. So do not eat the cakes of light.
Chances are you won't find out if you join anybody.
No, you won't. They'll take your money. They'll make you eat cum, and then you'll get nothing for it.
You might as well just do pornography.
You might make
more.
dude, I read some stuff. Like I've been talking to a lot of people involved, like occult groups, and they're like, yeah, I left because it was going a certain direction.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, listen, I think people like get into this stuff because they want to find that, they want no Gnosis. They want to get close to God. They want to get the truth. These guys don't have it. They don't. And it's a scam. Don't get scammed. The real groups, you're never going to hear about them. If there are real groups, that is, you know, they're probably like,
they're probably for people who are of a certain bloodline or some.
Yeah. Yeah.
Racist probably, shit.
Yeah. Some weird stuff. Like you're they're not going to like, you know, hand it to you. Just like, you know, praise the Lord. Say your prayers, take your vitamins. All the stuff Hulk Hogan said, listen to Hulk Hogan.
Listen to Hulk Hogan about that.
Oh God, don't let's cut that part out. Do not listen to Hulk Hogan. Anyway, just riffing at the end here.
Well, let me, I don't know if you're working to it, but I know we've been going a long time, but
yeah.
Were you going to get to, or were you going to lead to Anders Breivik? That might be a good,
yeah, let's
like real mind fuck right at the end.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you have all these like Neo-Templar groups. Like you talked about the Solar Temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and we've talked about Hidden Masters, right?
Yeah.
So we've talked about the Templars, the Neo-Templar groups, Hidden Masters, you know, and how the Hidden Masters sort of play a big role in these occultic groups. And I've kind of poo-pooed it a lot. And maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. One of the latest flare-ups in regards to the Templar, the Neo-Templar idea, happened in 2011 with Anders Breivik in his attack, his terrorist attack. Breivik believed he was in contact with a Templar hidden master who was basically guiding him to commit that atrocity. Now, that is a strange thing when we put everything together. Remember, was Breivik in, like, did Breivik know this information about hidden masters? Was he an occultist? I like, for me, like that, those are the big questions. Like,
yeah,
you know, like it's a bit odd.
Yeah. Cause like for me at the end of the day, I'm generally a materialist for the most part.
Same. Yeah.
And, or at least I try to bring that to the table here. Right. And like, in my mind, the thing that I jump to is, okay, was the intelligence agent that was like gaslighting him and leading him into this Templar shit themselves?
Well, I'll tell you this. If Breivik was gassed up by an intel agent about the Templars, it tracks for me a little bit, because the CIA kind of considers themselves America's version of the Knights Templar.
Hmm.
There is something to be said that a lot of intel agents love to, or agencies kind of like love to wear that mantle as well. Remember, this is a symbol charged with like the idea of the protectors of the realm, the protectors of the pilgrims, right?
Mm-hmm.
The great protectors, the knights, the shining knights on that, you know, there's something there, man. Like, why is this guy, this absolute like loser who had really nothing going on, believing he's a member of the Knights Templar, that he is given occultic knowledge from a Templar Grandmaster like Von Hund was, you know, centuries earlier? There's the echo is too weird for me too.
Yeah, like it doesn't really track. It's not exactly like I mean, like, Lord knows we know that, like, Templars in a general sense are popular on, like, 4chan and shit. Mm-hmm. But, like, the hidden master part of the Templars is not, like, the most well-known or popular aspect to the Templars.
Not at all. It's actually one of, I think, other than, like, the Gnostic stuff we covered, which is really, like, I am no expert on Gnosticism. That's probably very obvious to most people who actually have an understanding of Gnosticism. Hearing that piece, no.
Me too.
Yeah,
like, I butchered my way through defining the demiurge, and it was so painful.
Yeah, it's a very complex thing. And, like, listen, I have a very broad base of knowledge, but it's very shallow, right? But what I do know is that the concept of hidden masters is very occultic. It's mm-hmm. very esoteric. The fact that Brevik is saying that he is a communication with hidden masters that guided him through this attack or this plan of attack, and that they are going to pop up in, you know, cleanse Europe is insane. It's just the echo of what happened previously. There's something there, man.
Yeah, like, separate from historical truth, like, people, like, bad people really like the Templars, and they yes. keep bringing it up over and over. That is definitely a takeaway for sure.
What do you think is it about the Templars that attracts these people to them?
I think, like you said, it's like a way to cast themselves doing heinous things as, in fact, like, in higher service of, like, a
yeah.
more noble good, right?
Right. In reality, it's you're just a butcher.
Yeah, you know, pretty much.
And the Templars themselves, like, they weren't good guys. I'm sure some of them were fine fellows, if probably not. Like, these guys were trained killers. That's who they were.
I mean, it's the people who, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's, like, fundamentally the knights who butchered Jerusalem who, like, were involved in forming it, right? Or am I getting the timeline wrong?
The timeline's a little wrong, because okay. it's about 20 years after the massacre of Jerusalem, so possibly possibly, you know, Hugh de Pound may have been one of those knights. I don't believe he was, but possibly some of the other members were. The point being, though, they were still a part of that crew, right?
Yeah,
they're still a part of that Frankish invasion that came to the Near East, to the Levant, and butchered innocent people. They butchered Christians, they butchered Muslims, they butchered Jews. Anyone in their way who wasn't like them, they killed. And the idea of the Templars being, like, these sacred protectors of Christianity, I mean, that's the idea, but did they actually do that? Because it seems that they were more busy with their business affairs than actually protecting anybody.
Yeah, like, Lord knows the Islamic leaders ended up being better protectors of Christianity than the Christians were.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the only like lapse really in, like, protection we have historically speaking is when the Seljuks kind of, like, I think it was the let me just give me a second, because the Seljuks weren't like a caliphate. They worked with a caliphate, and I want to get the name right. I think it's the Abbasid Caliphate, right? So they worked beside, like, they were basically the armed wing of the Abbasid Caliphate, the Seljuks. And the Seljuks were, you know, they were Central Asian steppe people, and they maybe didn't get the politics of the area, or, you know, whatever. The point being, it's that, like, you're correct. You know, you have people like Saladin, and you have other Muslim leaders who are much more accepting and peaceful. And remember, they were more sophisticated than the Western Christians. Mm-hmm. They just were. And it wouldn't, like, it's the whole thing with the Templars being, like, the great defenders of the faith. Like, okay, how long did they hold Jerusalem? I think it was, like, 60 something years. Really? And then the rest of the time they're spending it on the coasts, just sort of, like, you know, hyping up the next crusade that's going to fail over and over again, getting countless amounts of people killed in the process just so they can, like, make their coffers fat. So, you know what, in the end, maybe Philip the Fair did nothing wrong except for the pilgrims.
He did nothing wrong in dealing with the Templars.
Yes, King Philip the Fair was a horrible piece of shit, but maybe icing the Templars wasn't a bad thing.
Hey, if nothing else, it set banking back, like, It's probably a couple hundred years, and that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, until the Italians took over and really ran with it.
Yeah.
You know, after the but yeah, I think that's kind of like the story of the Templars. You have like this transnational military / financial horror show that cut its way through Europe and the Near East, and then was finally got by a mafia Don King. That's their story.
It's all barbarism.
It's all barbarism all the way down, and basically in the end, a bunch of weirdo nerds who don't touch grass created an entire fan fiction around them.
I mean, that tracks for me.
It tracks for me too.
Oh man. No, that's awesome. So should we, let's see here. Cause you don't currently have anything to plug, I don't think, right?
I have nothing to plug. Like, I might do something like I later down the road, but I have nothing to plug now.
Well, if and when you ever do like either your video essay or your, you know, a podcast or something, like for sure we'll plug that. And then we'll have to have you back on here for some of the other topics we talked about. That'll be really fun.
Oh man, like the Templars is a weird one.
Yeah.
But like I think that some of the other groups we talked about, like that I went way too far into.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have an idea of who we should touch on next, and we'll talk about that later. But yeah. Jimmy, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm a huge fan and first time, long time, all that stuff. And it's been a pleasure. You've been awesome, and thank you so much.
Murder, murder, fight to defend Jerusalem from the human flesh. The deadly black blast in their eyes. The first crusade is won. The knights realize too late. Their ankles are covered with Christian blood.